He's here to share his experience, strength, and hope in his recovery, and I'd like you to help me welcome him warmly, Steve S.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Steve S. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for that lovely introduction and for your hospitality, Yvette, and George for flagging me into Pittsburgh, and to Area 60 for affording me to spend this weekend with you. I'm glad to be here. I thought people were saying that we have a Rolls Nice. I have a couple of bicycles, and I was telling somebody my bicycle Rolls Nice. I moved to New York City from Minnesota. I feel close to home because a number of people have guessed that that's where I'm from based on my accent. So now I'm a little closer to Minnesota than when I'm in New York. Most people think I'm from Canada, and I tell them I am. It's Southern Canada. I got asked not to bore you to death tonight by one of your fellows, so I'm going to do my best at that. My higher power was looking out for me. George got talking to me. Well, first him and his wife told me a lovely love story between the two of them, and then we talked hockey. So all my nerves went away. And between that and coming up here, I gave the best AA talk I've ever given in my head. And y'all look very nice tonight. Everybody's cleaned up well. It's a lovely crowd, and I was encouraged once by a speaker to always remember that everybody you're talking to is throwing up on themselves at one time or another, probably. And so have I, so. And somebody said, I hope God speaks through you, and I said, I do too. I heard a speaker share that they used to say, people say, oh, thank you for talking, and they'd say, well, yeah, if anything helped you, it was God speaking through me, you know? And they said, well, it wasn't that good, you know? Keep the pressure off a little. If you're new to an assembly, I've met at least one person who's new to a service assembly. My first service assembly I attended in southern Minnesota, and I had been around service, and a number of the people, you know, through group life. So there was people there I was familiar with, but the assembly was new, and there was this big debate fired open about newsletters and sharing mailing addresses. And I didn't know much about the circumstances, you know. But there was some real divided opinion about it, and some of the same people kept going up to the mic, you know, one after another. You know, it was like Federer and Nadal or something, you know. Finally, there was a pause, and the chair asked if the past newsletter chair, who had been the editor for, I don't know, a couple of decades or something, could share any experience on it. And this older fellow got up to the mic, and he said, "But you know, in 20 years, I never had any problem with what's being talked about. You know, it never came up." And everybody just erupted in laughter because the whole discussion was just kind of pointless, you know. And I knew I was in the right place, you know. And that's been my experience at group business meetings, service assemblies. I've felt it here this weekend, you know, that people that people have a deep desire to do what's best for AA that's almost unnameable or indescribable unless you have it. And if you can feel that here, you're definitely going to have a good time in service, I would tell you, you know, if you can feel any of that here. Because a lot of times I still, like, listening to the sharing on the agenda items has been terrific. There's so many things I wouldn't think about the topics without listening to so many other people. That makes it always fascinating. But what really attracts me is the love people have for AA. I love being sober, and I love you know, going to my meeting, and I also love, I really don't see it as separate anymore, being amongst people who love AA and talk about AA at AA. It's really a great crowd to be amongst. So, and then to do that, you know, people are going to hear things I've already shared, because I guess it brings it up to my mind what gets asked of me, you know, what do you think of the weekend, to be amongst people who I haven't met and feel a part of that, and have had a chance now with a staff position to travel around the U.S. and Canada and be well aware of people I know and have grown fond of are doing the same thing all over the United States and Canada right now, getting ready to, you know, try to come together around what's best for our fellowship and what's best for those who haven't found a solution to their alcoholism, you know, who are out drunk tonight and maybe tomorrow or next month or a year from now might encounter the saving grace of AA, that all these people all over the US and Canada are sitting around, you know, volleying at the microphones and fumbling around with background they don't understand and doing all the things we do to try to just come up with a good decision, you know. It's really moving. And I got to walk around with Bill Wilson. I'm going to boast about that when I get back to you. If you haven't met Bill, sorry, I don't know, does that break someone's anonymity if I say that? Because it's kind of... I'm going to start with service. You know, the conference, the Spiritual Way of Life, Recovery, you know, our steps, traditions, and concepts. I guess the being in the conversations, the service part. My first service commitment beyond the group was to go to a corrections. Actually, I first went to a detox, but I don't know who brought... This guy I knew brought me there. I got in a car with three other people. I only knew one person. I didn't even talk to the other two guys. Went to the detox meeting. I didn't talk. I just said pass. Had no idea, like, what am I doing here, you know, because I hadn't worked any steps. There was just this guy who took me under his wing, and just I went because he asked me, and he was going. I felt better being there. That was kind of unnerving too, like, wow, I feel good being in this detox with, you know, people who look as angry as I feel. But it felt better, and the ride home was so pleasant, and you know, I wouldn't go back to doing that for a while. But eventually at a meeting there was a guy who made this long, boring, slower speech than I have announcement of an opportunity to bring the message into a correctional facility nearby. And I, for like a month, I just was hoping he wasn't going to raise his hand to make an announcement, you know? I was not in the condition of really thinking of others much at all. But it was suggested to me you might think of doing something to be helpful to others. And so I finally asked this guy, what is this deal that you're announcing after like a month and a half, you know? And so he showed me the sheet to sign up, and that took me a few weeks to find a pen, I guess. And then, you know, by then I had picked up the drift from people telling me, if you say you're going to do something, you do it, and you do it consistently. That's what commitment means. So it's a service commitment. And so I did it. I followed through with it. And within like 4 months of going to this once-a-month county jail meeting, something happened, you know? Like something happened where I was like sitting outside after the jail meeting with another guy that was going with me, like, I don't know, the sky seemed brighter. Just everything seemed clearer, you know? And so the next time I saw this guy with the announcements, I said, Carl, how come you make that announcement all the time, you know? Because I'm really a curious person like that. This is almost 5 months later. My inquisitive mind had kicked in. And he said, well, I'm the district corrections committee chair. And I said, what is that, you know? And so he said, well, we meet on Mondays at the same place as the Thursday meeting. Why don't you come down? I said, okay. So I went down there, and the first district meeting I went to, there was a delegate's report back. And this guy, Mark, was there. And he talked about a bunch more things I didn't know anything about, you know? But he was so poised and so pleasant that it appealed to me. I kind of wondered how he ended up being a part of these things he was saying he was doing. And it was a little unattractive because he said he went to New York City and spent the whole week in a hotel, conference rooms, you know. So I was still kind of like, well, that doesn't sound like a lot of fun, you know. Like, you're in New York and you're sitting in meeting rooms, you know, kind of like this weekend. Go to Pittsburgh and hang out in conference hotel rooms, you know. Soon after that, I was at a roundup and we were in a hospitality room. And I was standing there eating something. And there's two guys I knew were talking, and the one guy was all excited because he had moved into an apartment and was getting free cable. And then, you know, me and the other guy are like, oh, cool, you know. And then Mark's standing there, he's snacking on something, and I recognize him from, oh, there's that guy that gave that New York trip talk, you know. And so he says, is it really free? I thought, what kind of question is that, you know? And the other guy said, yeah, I don't have to pay for it. And he said, but why don't you have to pay for it? Well, because it was still hooked up from the last person. And he says, so it's not really free, you're just not paying for it. And I thought, wow, he's really ruining the party, you know? But that really hit me, you know, the same guy who's standing there talking about this whole week he spent in the conference rooms of a hotel is now just pleasantly challenging somebody if whether or not he's stealing, you know? And some dots started connecting, you know? And I can say that being around people like that for some time has had a great, great impact on the quality of my life, you know? A lot of it has been said here this weekend about example. Just the power of his example is something really, really terrific. So I'm going to trace back, giving a little hint of some of the spiritual malady I was under, right? Like not feeling like I'm a part of anything, being willing to lie, cheat, and steal, demanding more out of life than life is offering me, anything from free cable to free drinks. It always tasted better when it was free, you know. I had my upbringing was in an alcoholic home. My father's passed away. He never told me he was an alcoholic. I was, so it was an alcoholic home, you know. And I gave him a run for his money as far as attitudes went. You know, we really got on good. So I drank off of what I could around the house, you know, when I was a kid. Used to fetch him beers and drink off of that until this was my first run at controlled drinking. It was when he told me you can no longer open the bottle before you get upstairs. You got to wait until you get to my chair. Because I was drinking at a rate that, you know, was too fast for, I guess, moderate or social drinkers would drink. I'm not sure. I think he just wanted as much out of the bottle as he could get, you know. There was a little machine, you know, down in the basement that was all full of nothing but beer, and it had an opener on it. So I liked using that thing, and I loved the feeling it gave me when I would drink it as I ran it up to him. And then the first drunk I had, you know, there was a lot of problems in my house over it. You know, when I was about 13, maybe 12, I had a real run-in with my dad. I don't remember what came of it or what it was over. It was frequent. And I had an older brother who really he's always had his wits about him, you know, and he looked at me when out of the earshot of our father, and he said, why do you do that? And I said, what? And he said, talk to him like that. And I said, it doesn't make any sense what he's saying. And my brother said, but you know he's been drinking. And it dawned on me like, oh, you know. And I was so self-centered, it didn't matter if he was drinking or not drinking. I was just looking around to get my way with whatever was going on, you know. About a year later, something else happened in my house where the pattern of dad drinking, mom getting mad, silence coming down, you know, dad making up to everybody. Nobody knows where dad is. Dad drinking, everybody pays for it, mom gets mad. Mom, you know, this thing that just went on and on for years. Suddenly there was a break, and when mom got mad, she didn't just, like, sit at the end of the couch. She was still doing things around the house. And then I heard my dad trying to, like, get an angle on her. And then finally I heard him yelling, and she wasn't yelling back. And I was like, and then I heard these words, Al-Anon, in the middle of it all. And I had never heard those words before, and I didn't know what that was, you know? And I like to think something reached me there, that there was some kind of power in the house that hadn't been in there before. And that maybe there was a hint of a way out of all this craziness. As a child, I prayed, just show me, whatever it takes, just show me how to get out of this craziness. You know, the fighting and the violence and all that comes along with it, you know. And I got to say, those prayers have been answered, but not till I had my own run at it, you know. So by the time I was through with sports was really my marker. I had planned a drunk. I wanted to get drunk once just to see what it was like. And a friend lined up some beers in this small town outside of Minneapolis called Shakopee, and it was in a barn sitting on a hay bale. And my friend arranged. I told him I didn't want to puke. I didn't know, but I was saving that for later. I was a puker, passer outer, and a blacker outer. Not a fighter or faller downer. I won't mention some of the other ones. But. So I hit that place with that first drunk, you know. My life felt, this guy that lined me up for drinking, he encouraged me not to do it, even though he drank a lot. He said, it's not what people make of it. Like, your life's good, why do you want to bother? And I told him some of what it was like to be me, you know, which when I got to the point where I said, I can't describe it, it just feels like someday I'm going to be crazy. And when he got real quiet and just stared at me, I was done telling anybody that, you know, until I got here. And you all laughed at it. So, the next week I was in a garage at a keg party with another classmate who was notorious for holding parties. And I sat next to the keg, and I became the beer pourer. And like everything else in my life, I was doing something for other people based on what I could get out of it. And that was an immediate refill on my cup. Right? That was kind of service position I held. So, and this classmate, Trent, kept coming by as everything, you know, I was still new, so this whole drunken thing was kind of fascinating to watch sort of happen, you know, like the way everything started to change. And then here would be Trent, like, you still sitting here? And all this noise and people and cups coming and going, and you still sitting here? Why don't you get up? And I remember consciously thinking to myself, why doesn't he leave me alone? Like, what would I do if I got up from the seat, you know? I didn't have any notion of social drinking. As I drank, I never really had even the context in my life to really even try to attempt that well, you know? You know, like where you have people you live with that you want to have a social drink with, you know? Most of my drinking just went on that way, like at the keg. And then that night I did something. I don't know what happened. I remember going into a room where a lot of people were and blacked out. And by the time I came to, it was the next day, and I had a kid sister who I was really close with, and she confronted me in our house, and she said, you know, I didn't think you'd be like those other guys. And she was 2 years younger than me, a sophomore in high school at the time, and I took one look at her and said, you know, I didn't even know what she was talking about, but I knew it had to do with the drinking. And I said, that's your problem. And she lost an older brother for the next 12 years. And it took me 3 years into AA to realize I had made that unconscious decision to choose drinking over her. Because I thought, well, I didn't really choose drinking over any family members. And because it wasn't a conscious thought. You know, I didn't look at her and think, you're in the way of my drinking. I'm not going to, you know, be a good big brother to you anymore. You know, I just said, that's your problem. Like, it had that kind of power over me, I guess, you know. And to this day, I don't know what went on in there. My sister went on to college. She, I have two other brothers who don't have problems with alcohol, you know, so she had good, you know, brotherly love in her life. And by the time it came to make amends to her, you know, I sat with her and told her I hadn't been the brother I would like to have been. And is there anything she wanted to say to me or anything I do to set things right? And she told me, she sobbed first. She just started sobbing. you know, I tell that because the neglect, you know, like from that moment that I said, that's your problem, until that day sitting with her, I exercised a neglect to her and my family that I didn't even know I was doing. My mom used to ask me, when did you move? You have a different phone number. I didn't know you moved. And I just had no idea the impact of that kind of treatment of other people, you know. And she said, my sister ended up saying, well, just show up where you say you're going to be. And I said, I can do that, you know, anything else. And she was like, no, just that. And she just gave me this look like, we'll see if you can do that, you know. She ended up having two children, and she's married, and I learned from AA, you know, like the service commitments, right? So if I said I was going somewhere, I showed up, I came early. If I was on the way to her house, I'd let her know I'm on my way. Sometimes I'd call her twice. It was a 40-minute drive, and she never once has said, why do you keep, I know you're coming, why? She's never, you know, and after it was maybe, I don't know how long I was sober, where her and her husband asked me to babysit their children while they were out of the house for the night. And they gave me that responsibility, and her little son was teething. And so he was having nightmares, she said. So if he's crying in the night, you know, don't get startled. He's just, they have dreams, and his teeth are coming in. And so in the middle of the night, you know, I should say, one of the things that kind of, to me, captures my bottom is that all this time I just felt like I could never be a father, you know, like I'm so empty inside, I'll neglect a child. And so the idea of spending the night there was kind of daunting to me, like, what if I really fail at something? Or I just always pictured myself being unwilling to get up and even bother with them, you know. And so in the middle of the night when he cried, I found myself in this hallway with him in my arms before I even knew I got out of bed. And that was the night I knew my life had completely changed. Like, without a doubt, I knew on the inside something had just been completely rearranged. And he was sleeping in this little race car bed. And so I put him in the bed and just was, you know, caressing his back while I think he was telling me what he was dreaming or something, because he was just mumbling a bunch of stuff, and then he just dozed off, and I could have sat there all night. I wasn't tired. It just felt so good, you know. You know, and that's kind of a broad brushstroke through the steps, you know, through the lens of one relationship. I could tell the same stories with my brothers, my mom, my father. You know, my drinking, it was talked about this weekend with the consequences. You know, how we all have different consequences, and how, you know, I mean, I could tell you stories of, you know, getting a DWI, and I can pitch it in a funny way, you know, where I couldn't tell the alphabet. You know, I kept getting stuck at U because I was looking right at the police officer, and finally just told him I'm drunk. I didn't want him to think I didn't know the alphabet, you know. Having a couple of moments of clarity during my drinking time where I was done drinking, like really shook to the core, like I got to stop doing this. Watching my father's life just demise, his health, his mental condition, his marriage, his relationship with me and my siblings. And then, you know, finding a reason or not, just having a beer put in front of me at lunch and thinking, I'll just have one with lunch. The next night, not knowing where my car is, you know, to wake up in the morning, got to drive around Minneapolis looking for my car. You know, I really heard the sentiment yesterday about the consequences are, that really tells me about my life being unmanageable. I sponsored a professional who was a clergy person and hardly had ever been drunk. And the look on their face when me and another person talked about drinking till you puke really startled me, like, And then admitting that there's some benefit to it because you get a kind of a second run at another drunk that's a little little different than the first. You know, and it helped this pastor be like, that's a problem, you know? Like, that's not normal. No, I've never experienced that. And to be able to say that there's a physiological reaction to the alcohol going on. That there was a time when I would throw up from drinking and feel so horrible that I'd think I'd never do this again. But then when that happens enough and that craving is still in there and you start back up and kind of get over whatever that transition time is, makes total sense to just keep drinking. I can't explain it. I can't explain that physiological reaction. And what happens, you know, once I'm drunk, to me or to you or anyone else is just as random as where you happen to be, I figure, you know? And then that mental obsession of, well, it's just one Michelob of Golden Draft and it's lunch. Oh, I'll just have that one. No thought to the fact that I haven't drank for a year and a half because the last time I quit, I was terrified from a night in jail and a news story that on the same night, a drunk driver had killed a family of four, everyone but the three-year-old in the back seat. Didn't come to mind. No thought of it. The fights at home, the fights I've been in, none of it come to mind. Just there's that bottle, I'll just have it. I can't explain it. That's my mental obsession. It's going to be different this time. I'm going to control and enjoy it this time. Next night, driving around in the morning looking for my car, no thought of any of that. No thought of the beer the day before, the urine, nothing. I didn't think of any of this until I got to AA and heard other people's stories of the way they drank and what alcohol did to their body. I didn't think of any of it. And I'll tell you, there was a guy in my meeting who would come on and off the first meeting I went to. There were no service positions. There was not even a name to this meeting. It met in this room in a building, a tribal building on the Shakopee, Mitawakan, and Dakota community, on a Indian reservation. But people came there, you know, and I got invited there, and I went, and people talked about drinking, and I identified with what they were saying, and eventually I started talking too. I mean, it took a while, but this one guy would come in every once in a while, and I came to be friends with him, and he was a cocaine addict. That's what he would introduce himself as. And he'd tell his stories. And I'd listen to him and think, well, now that's crazy. Because they had these steps on the wall, and I had read all of them from my chair. And the thought of anything moral sounded kind of put me off. I didn't like the word. I didn't really know what it was, but I didn't like it. Making direct amends to people. I told myself I was overboard, but it terrified me. So my out was, well, this guy crawls around on the carpet trying to do coke. I'm not that bad. Right? Because I'm still deciding, blot out my consciousness or accept spiritual help? Every once in a while, this guy showed up and blotted out my consciousness. Sounded like it might be an option. Right? I might not need to do what all you people are doing to stay sober. But eventually, you know, I went to one meeting a week, and I was, it felt good for that 1 hour. And the pattern was kind of usually within an hour after, I was in a fight. I had done the program of action of getting married to get sober. She was doing the same thing. Yeah. If you've tried that, you know, it's a lot of fun. And so I, you know, within an hour, usually I'd be in a fight. By Friday, there would be, like, horrible decisions in front of us, like, do we want to split up this? By Sunday morning, I'd be planning my suicide. And by Tuesday, I'd be crawling into this Wednesday noon, I'd be crawling into this meeting, you know, with a head full of a plan for suicide. Feel better for an hour. Somewhere in the course of that hour, somebody would say they go to 3 or 4 meetings a week. And I'd think, you poor soul, you know? And then do the same thing. I did this for months. But in that hour, I would listen, and I would hear plenty of stories about people. I mean, it was a small meeting, but I'm so glad, you know. I'm sure anyone that stays sober loves the first meetings they go to because they work, right? Don't drink and you won't get drunk. That was about the only thing that I could kind of get my mind around. It's not your last drink, but your next drink that you got the biggest problem with. That one sounded like calculus, you know? Kind of like the countdown. I was really enjoying the countdown, watching every... And then when it got close to my years and it was more than this and less than that, I suddenly had to do math, and I'm like, oh, geez. Okay, yeah. Yeah. Then I felt bad after I sat down because I thought, did I go to the wrong year? Oh. But... And then the other thing they said that was really helpful to me was, if you don't drink, or if you want to drink, go drink. You know, and I'm... And then on the flip side, you know, there was the guy who every week said hi to me on the way out the door, because I was cutting out quick, right? And he'd be there and say hello and put out his hand. And his name was Larry, and I always like to tell about Larry because I was certain he was a pervert. Why is this guy saying hi to me? You know, he was about 20 years older than me. I was 30 at the time. He was probably 50. Then the next day, he'd remember my name. I think now he's really creeping on me, you know? And when I was sober about 13 years after I hadn't seen him for maybe 6 years, because of meeting changes, I saw him at a roundup and he put his hand out and said hi the same way he had every week. And I was so glad to see him. We gave each other hugs. And I just, wow, you know. So that, and honestly, it felt good. Even though I was afraid of him, I could feel that I felt better to be there. And I started to look forward to what he had to say, you know. And to me, it was the attraction, you know, when I look at the traditions. I wasn't interested in becoming a member, right? I didn't have any capacity to belong to anything. I didn't know if I had a desire to stop drinking. I desire for trouble to stop, but the attraction of people being kind and the unity I felt, the laughter, the warmth, that people were there every week and didn't want anything from me, you know, that was appealing to me, that nobody was in charge. That was appealing to me. I didn't have to sit there and eyeball for who I had to get one over on or start to hate or whatever because they're going to boss me around. I could actually listen to people. And they had a singleness of purpose. I could relate to what they were talking about. And to me, there was no authority that could include me or exclude me. Nobody had that authority. It was left to me. If you want to drink, go drink. So when I would leave that meeting during the week and be all twisted up inside and be thinking I'd rather just get wasted, I would hear that. If you want to drink, go drink. And then I realized I don't want to. That's how I found out I actually have a desire to stop drinking. And I would say I was an alcoholic, but I didn't really know what one was. But slowly it started to catch on, you know. And was my life unmanageable? Yeah, it had been, but I'm probably going to come up with some better ideas of how to improve it than these steps. Because I'm a clever guy like that. So I waited, and in the meantime, my father, while drinking, took his own life. And I know there's people in here who have that going on in their life. Some people have shared some things with me this weekend that they've had that in their families. And no booze, no higher power, no direction, bad ideas, unspeakable grief, a bad combination, you know. There's a few months I don't even know for sure what I was doing. And there was one guy, Al, who I would talk to, and he had said to me in 100 different ways, you got to surrender. You know, different problem every 3 days, same story. I'm trying to control this, and it's not working out. I didn't have that basic formula at the time because it was her and this and that and whatever, and he'd listen. You got to wave the white flag. You got to get on your knee. You got to. And so my plan to slit my throat had, you know, I had done some especially vile things in my home with that woman that I had been married to, and it was 2 a.m., and I thought, this is it. A drink won't help. I'm coming up zeros. I'm done, you know? And so I had this switchblade razor that was an heirloom from my dad's side of the, you know, and this thing kept running through my head that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. I couldn't get that out of my mind for 3 months, and I finally just thought, it's doomed, you know, your fate or whatever that is, you know? And so I went into this bathroom in our apartment, and I picked up the razor blade and looked in the mirror, and then I heard Al's voice, like he was standing right there in the restroom, you know, right there next to me. I heard him say, you got to get on your knees, you know? And before I knew it, I was halfway down the hall, and I'm thinking to myself, this is stupid, you know? And then I thought, well, you can always go back in there, and the option's still there, you know, like, this isn't going to work, you can just go back in there. But I kept walking, you know, and the same way I felt at my going to my first meeting, the same way I felt picking up my nephew, the same way I felt getting out of my last scrape of my last drunk in 1998. That was in a hotel room, went into a bathroom begging to be let out of this room where all kinds of things were going on that I hadn't done yet. And I was just like, this has got to stop. Please get me out of here. Going down the hallway out of that hotel, it just felt like something was carrying me. Wound up in the living room, got on my knees, closed my eyes. Felt like the whole world was looking at me, and I was embarrassed and ashamed that I was so weak. Wind was blowing, there were shadows all over the living room, and a prayer murmured out that my mom had taught me as a child. And when I opened my eyes, it was calm. Even the shadows weren't moving. And there was a presence in the room that was so undeniably full of love and power that I just soaked it in. And my first thought was, those AA people, this for real. What they're talking about is for real. That was the first thought that came to me. And then I heard a voice from the end of the hall, and it was my wife. And she said she was sorry for fighting. She said, I have never meant to hurt you. And I know you don't mean to hurt me. I hope you sleep good. And because I was routinely on the couch at this time. So... And I did. That was the first time that ever happened. These arguments were frequent, right? The paint peeling kind of arguments. And at the same, you know, and then I just thought, wow, this is too much, you know. And I slept. I woke up for the first time in I don't know how long. My stomach wasn't upset when I woke up. And I really haven't, it's been at my back ever since, you know. I'm full of character defects and fears and misperceptions, and but that strength of that power greater than myself has been undeniably present to me ever since. And I tell you what, you know, I've been in meetings, and I would hear people forget, you know, this is just my experience, but I would hear people say they were too cowardly to kill themselves, and I would want to go across the table, and, you know, I took it so personal, like they're calling my dad a coward. He wasn't a coward. There were 300 people at his wake. They couldn't fit him in the door. He was a good man, you know? And this guy, Al, told me, you know, well, that's okay, you know, like... That's their idea. That's their understanding of themselves. You need your own understanding. And I said, I don't know what to make of it. And he told me this story about the buffalo. That was Lakota. And he said, you know, the buffalo, there's a way of hunting the buffalo where the hunters will run the buffalo to a cliff. And the front, one of the buffalo in the front will go off the cliff, and the death is instant. It's merciful. The rest of the herd stops because they sense that one of them went over. And then they have a special ceremony for that buffalo that went over first. Every once in a while, he said, there's a story of one peeling off from the herd before the cliff. And they can't explain how that buffalo knows that there's a cliff ahead before any of the others go off. And so when that buffalo would get taken, they had a different ceremony for that buffalo. And he said, That's who the alcoholics like your dad are. You can honor your dad's death. He showed you what was ahead. And I know that night, you know, when they said the apple isn't going to fall far from the tree, and that was Al who said, you got to get on your knees, and, you know, it's all a part of me seeing a different way. And I can say that there's been blessings from that death. You know, I've sat with people in AA, you know, new people, they got their hard luck stories. And some of them, we got bad problems when we come in here. I don't want any of them back that I had when I showed up. I don't want any of them. I'll take the ones that are coming. It'll be plenty. But I'm not fazed, you know, because I'm like, you're sitting here telling me, you know, there's worse waiting for us, you know. There's worse waiting for us. It's progressive and it's deadly, you know. And so, you know, off of that, I did what people said, you know. I got a sponsor and started doing what he told me to do, and that was right out of the big book. He told me to do what was in the book. And I had enough people I was chatting with, so I had a good number of people I could go to when things that were in the book weren't making sense to me, or what the actions were getting overwhelming, and I wasn't sure what to make of things. And so I got guided through these steps, you know, where I made lists of harms and asked for my character defects to be removed, and went and made amends to people. And like I demonstrated with some earlier stories, I've had a complete psychic change. My life has been completely transformed through a power greater than myself. And now my chore has been to maintain that and grow that kind of relationship. And I have found the idea of carrying the message to other people to be kind of like tasting good food at a restaurant and telling somebody about the restaurant. I can't help myself. You know, it's appealing. Like, I enjoy doing it. Now, I have misperceptions. I can think, seems like a lot better idea not to take somebody's call. Somebody wants to talk to me in the morning. I got to do it at 8 a.m. My bed is nice up there. I'm thinking, well, I want to stay in bed, you know. But I know, tell them yes. I can take your call in the morning. How about this time? You know, it's appealing. It's 10-2, so anybody nodding off? I'm gonna see a couple people nodding off. It's always a little curious sharing as a, you know, I'm here as a staff member, right? So somebody said, what do you think of the weekend? I'm an AA member first, so sometimes nothing comes out about being a GSO staff member because I'm at an AA meeting. You know, and I don't know. I guess I could tell you that some of the things I've heard this weekend about New York, GSO, really with respect to my colleagues, our general, as an AA member, I'll tell you, our general service board, those people are unpaid. 21 trustees that are unpaid. If you want to know the salaries of me or anybody else at the office in your considerations of a budget, these are serious things we're talking about. You can get that information from Human Resources and the general manager. With respect to my colleagues, there's about almost 90 employees there, and not all of us are on six figures. Right? People come up for tours. You're going to meet those people. Right? Come up for a tour. You can meet somebody who sent you a workbook. Right? Put it in an envelope and sent it out. I'd be happy to introduce you to them. You know, and what their salaries are is based on what the conference has set for, what the fellowship has said, that we do that at a level that's equal pay for the work in the place where it is. And I only say out of respect to them because there's some wonderful people up there. I hope you can come visit. We have some workers that have been there 30 plus years because they know what AA does. They're not alcoholics, some of them, and they know what AA does, and they love where they work, to go to work every day and have a purpose. So I want to clear up, to me, those were some misconceptions that kind of concerned me that I heard over the weekend a couple times. Hopefully it informs your discussions. The GSO, like my position is one of 12 staff positions where it's required to be an alcoholic. Not a lot of jobs in the world where blacking out. Tracy was here a couple of years ago. I loved the teaser because in the box 459 was this article about, and her quote about not being able to show up for work. And I was like, where else does an organization put that in their newsletter that one of their new employees like used to not be able to come to work on? But it's to identify and be able to relate information to both AA members and the public, right? And then there's people in a whole bunch of other departments that help support groups and members to carry the A message. And some of the things you talked about this weekend, as a staff member, a lot of you know more about what's unfolded with the items than I do. Because some of the things come out of the General Service Board, you know, which is, you know, through the general manager executes what goes on at GSO. And I've got to answer to my general manager. So some of the things the board is doing, I'm not at their meetings. I'm not aware of the timing of some of the things that come out of their meetings. And with all that I'm doing at work, I might get an email the same time your delegate does and not have a chance to read it as close as they do, and you might have already discussed it by the time I get a chance to read it. But what I would like to impart to you is that the feeling of what I've witnessed there is the group conscience working, you know, which, again, as an AA member first, that is very important to me, to be able to, the AWS board meetings we do get to sit in on, and to see the same kind, I mean, if, take my word, if you sat in there, and if you've sat in any group conscience meeting in AA at your group or anywhere, you would recognize what's going on in the AWS board meeting. It's the same. Dead horses come in. Everything. There's long pauses, and somebody says, what exactly, where are we at with this? You know? And the same just drive to try to, you know, are we really approaching what's best for AA? And my most immediate experience with that was when I started, I started 3 years ago there, at the Treatment Special Needs Accessibilities Desk, and I was getting calls from a few members who were interested in having more audio material available online. And a lot of things happened during that assignment that really made me understand some matters of having the message available to people differently than I could possibly know without having communication with people who face certain challenges, right? So, oh yeah, so I look at the website and there's like hundreds of things that I can just click on and open up and read. But if you have sight problems of some kind, limitations, there's nowhere near an equivalency of material available. And so I went to the staff assignment that coordinates the website and say, hey, can you put at least the big book up online in audio? And they were like, I was still kind of new, you know, and they were like, well, me? No, you know, like, it's got to go to a committee. And I was like, oh, can you write a memo for that? Yeah, sure, you know. So it all starts, right? But we make these decisions this way. So I went to this committee, and then in the board meeting, there was a discussion about it. And a lot of different angles got brought up. And then it was apparent that that's a good idea. And once that was decided, you know, it dawned on somebody, one of the board members said, you know, if I'm drunk at 2 a.m., I might be more likely to listen to the big book than try to read it. And then it just was so beautiful to me, because the thoughtfulness of who we're overlooking led to something that would be beneficial to all of us, right? And so I've since listened to the big book in 12 and 12 on my headphones when I'm commuting or riding around. And so it's just one example that I see that I hope you can trust that as much as anyone you're around here, I've just found AA to be the same everywhere I go. You know, it's like at this level where people want the best for AA, and we don't always know what it is, and it can be a little clumsy along the way trying to find it out, but the sentiment's the same, the process is the same, and I don't think any of us really know, but I guess I want to end with saying that I really honor your participation, and I hope that you encourage that you continue with all that you're doing and whatever you're led to continue to do in AA. As has been mentioned, I think we're in really special times. Maybe not like the time, I wonder about when Bill and Bob were saying, well, you know, we're going to pass away. How's this going to happen? And those years between that awareness and members of AA saying, yeah, we can take responsibility through this conference. Like, there were years between those two events when who knew? Nobody knew if it would work. It's been working. Look at all of us. And maybe we're at a time of something else that's similar in scale, that something's going to change. And right now, we don't know what shape it could take, you know? But hopefully, if we stick together and keep in the process, we'll find our way and continue to be able to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Yeah? So thank you for listening. I'm going to close with that, and love you all, and appreciate you listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.